the Property Coaching and Wealth Creation Podcast, brought to you by property and business coach Daniel Latto. Join the conversation at www.daniellatto.co.uk. Remember to like and subscribe.
This is part two of my interview with Mark Donnan. If you've missed part one, go back and listen to that and then catch up with this one.
As in going overseas. Divorce and debt.
Right, what you're describing are what I call change events. So what a change event is at a given, and they're pretty heavy ones, because at a given period in your life, at a given period in time, these things that you've just described completely polarize how people view the world. Yeah. There's actually 50 of these. You've described four of them. And for that period of time, it acts like a picture frame or a pair of glasses or a telescope or whatever way you want to look at it. But yeah, you can only see through that lens for that period of time. There's other ones. There's the death of a pet, the death of a parent. There's the getting fired kids from a job. There's a whole bunch of them.
Yeah.
The birth of kids is a change event. That's really right. Yeah.
Or separation as well.
Separation and you know,
separation from kids. Separation. That was one of my big ones.
It's a big one that I know that we share.
Yeah.
So those change events become the filter that I was talking about earlier on, and because you know that people are going through that process, that change event at that time, you can bypass their radar of irrelevance. So that, you know, if you're advertising to somebody where it's not relevant, the message just bounces off. It shields up, bounces off, it doesn't get through. Yep. Whereas a change event is a hole in that radar. It allows you to get the right psychological message through. But actually, if you pick one of them, you say death or whatever, that's a huge motivational factor. But it's not part of the segmentation. The segmentation of the reasons beyond that, why they might be involved in buying. So, you know, death might have four. What do you say? Debt might have four or five psychological segments. You know, since I know a little bit about the debt market, I'll concentrate on that one. You know, so someone that's highly motivated to maybe sell their property because they're in debt will do so for a number of different reasons. First one is sheer embarrassment. You know, they've had their value smashed. They feel worthless. They don't want to feel worthless. So it's the sheer embarrassment factor.
I can add on to that, Mark, because we use that in our marketing, and we say no for sale boards. So that actually helps deal with the fact that they may be embarrassed.
Absolutely.
And the neighbours don't get to see the fact that we've put the house up for sale. And also, we park the car around the corner, so we don't park outside saying we buy houses for cash, because otherwise the neighbours would be like, oh, that's not very good. That's really interesting.
Yeah, and in your sales interview, you've got the perfect opportunity when you're doing the face to face to handle all of the other issues. But you know, you've got their values that their parents passed on to them, and you know, and if they're in that situation, it's usually people of my age and above that are in the third stage of their life, and they've hit a life event, a change event, as you know, that's happened, and now they're trying to deal with that change, and that change makes them, you know, vulnerable, and responsible marketers have to take account of that, as I'm sure, and I know that you do.
What else other than embarrassed is he?
Well, I was just getting it. So you've got them. I'm thinking off the top of my head now, right? But you've got they're dealing with the embarrassment factor. Yeah. The other thing, and those are people that maybe have, you know, as I said, they've got those established values. You got some of the other people that just don't really care. They just want rid of the pain. So they're just like, it's painful. Take it off me. I'll do whatever I need to get rid of it right now. And they're not thinking about the consequences of the second, third and fourth step.
We've had one of those, 48% below market value. And it was a couple, and they were going through a divorce, and it was like, is it Kramer versus Kramer, where they really hate each other and kill each other?
Yeah, something like that.
It was worse than that, and they just wanted rid, because they would have killed each other, for sure.
You see, the danger with people like that, when they're the ones that get the buyer remorse, because they're highly stimulated emotionally, and buying through a very strong emotional filter rather than a mixture. The best buyers make a mixture of emotion and logic. You've got to take account of the logic, the post-purchase, we call it the post-purchase evaluation, because people do then reflect on the decisions that they've made when the salesman leaves the house, or they've bought the thing, or that, you know, eventually the mind makes them contemplate and reflect on what they've done. And if they don't agree with their own decisions, that exacerbates the problem, and they feel even worse, and therefore they, you know, they you know, the brave people return it, or I didn't want this, or then, yeah. Or they maybe blame you that you sold it to them wrongly. You know, you look at the whole mis-selling of.
We would then follow up as well with a letter, which would go into some of the logic as to why they've done it anyway,
exactly.
As it happens.
Of course.
That's part of our process, which is
of course.
Interesting.
But knowing it in advance, you see, we're talking about segmentation gateways. At the minute, you'll spot that in a meeting. We're talking about trying to get that experience into the front end so that you can take people down that particular route. And as you say, you've already built it into your marketing by saying, you know, no boards. And that's a clever way of taking these post-purchase decisions, these psychological understandings, and bring it into your marketing. Now, if you just expanded that embarrassed sector up a bit more, you could, you know, in a half a day, you could blow up a funnel just for the people that might be in that position, both triggering them to buy, you know, getting them on the phone call. Whereas people that really are in pain, they don't care about being embarrassed. They're beyond that by now. They just want rid of the pain. And then you've got other ones who really just don't really care about money at all. And then you've got other ones that feel entitled, and you know they're the ones that are probably a little bit, you know, maybe drinking a little bit, medicating themselves a little bit more than they should because they feel that the world has done them a great disservice. You know, it's not their fault that they're in this situation. The world turned on them, and they haven't got a coping mechanism, and they haven't got responsibility, and they can't handle the fact that they're actually the person, and nobody else has put them in this position. And they've got a whole different set of emotions going on, which are all about significance and understanding and ego, and the ego being bruised. And they need a different set of, So, you know, we could go on all day on this, but that's the kind of thing that you can get into on your segmentation gateway. You know, if you ask the question, three questions on the homepage. What would your mother think of this? What would your mother think of you? Or, you know, that would probably reinforce negativity, wouldn't it? You know, but something along the lines that got them to click the button to see how they can, how you're dealing with that legacy challenge, or get rid of the pain right now. You know, these are obviously rubbish marketing headlines, but I'm just illustrating the segmentation bit. Or, you know, do you deserve better? And, you know, you've got different trigger points that will take people down to different funnels, into different segments, different ways in which you can persuade that person to lift the phone and make the call or to click the download or get the thing.
Yeah, that's really interesting because we do rotate our leaflets as well that target, you know, death, departure, divorce and debt. But actually, after this conversation, like the debt one, embarrassed or just getting rid of pain, but there are actually two separate segments there, and we could probably tighten up on those leaflets even more, especially as the leaflet strategy that we have doesn't cost us a penny to drop leaflets because we drop pizza companies and taxi ranks. We've got a little leaflet dropping company, so we can drop 50,000 leaflets and it doesn't cost us a penny. So it doesn't matter if that 50,000 is specifically about not being embarrassed about having to sell your house.
Yeah,
it doesn't matter because it doesn't cost us a penny, which is, compare that to, say, Google pay-per-click or Facebook pay-per-click. Obviously, there's a cost inherent in that. I just wanted to know, how did you actually get into marketing? What was the... Because you know so much about marketing. It's really interesting speaking to you after so long of not speaking to you. How did you get into it originally? And what is it that motivates you to go out and help people with their marketing?
Well, I'm a failed accountant. I went to all the way through school.
Not a bad thing, you know.
No, I grew up in Northern Ireland, as you can tell from the accent, and it was a time when it was very violent, and you know, it was right in the middle of all that stuff that was going on in the war. And I'm one of those kids, you know, from 1969 when I was born, all the way through my whole childhood, all the way through into my 20s, I was brought up in that cauldron, and I had to get out. I had to do something to leave and get out from underneath that. And I was just fortunate enough that I managed to get myself an education on the route. So I didn't trip over a laptop on a beach. I studied.
Yeah.
And I got a job in a warehouse. I was a student. And I got a job in a warehouse. I was sweeping the floor in this warehouse. That was my job, to keep the dust under control in this big warehouse. And a rep came in a Sierra. Do you remember those cars? A Ford Sierra.
Yeah.
A rep came in. He was in a suit. He had a mustache and brown Sierra. And he was coming in to pick up samples that were housed in the warehouse. And he came up and he spent an hour having a cup of tea with us and the rest of the men. Of course, you know, I am the student, the skinny student in a boiler suit. I mean, you can just imagine it, can't you? Go and do this, go and I had to make the tea and everything. So he sat an hour wasting time chewing the fat with the warehouseman. And I thought, I want that job. I want to do that. He's getting paid for sitting here talking to us. So
my job now, actually.
It's a bit like your job. Funny how it all comes around again, isn't it?
Because yeah.
So I decided I would become a salesman. But the problem was I was at university at the time, and I was studying to be an accountant. I wasn't very good at it, and in fact I was rubbish at it. So I switched to do business studies, and that's when really I discovered that I had this passion for wanting to earn money, but not do a lot for it, like this guy. So ultimately, then I became a sales rep, and that allowed me to understand that language and persuasion was something that, you know, when you grow up in Northern Ireland, you're pretty good at talking to people and talking your way out of trouble. You can imagine some of the scrapes I had.
Yeah.
So, you know, and then I ended up working for an organization, which ultimately led me through a number of other steps to being on the brand launch team for Tropicana when Tropicana came to the UK. So I launched it, and then that went so well, I got Häagen-Dazs, right. And I was on the creative team and working with Häagen-Dazs, and then that got me a role at Mars Confectionery. They wanted to move into ice cream in a major way. And I ended up doing brand roles in Mars all the way through. European ice cream jobs, global marketing teams. When Tesco built the Tesco Club Card, I was part of that team that was doing all that. So I ended up in a whole bunch of big senior jobs in corporate and understanding more than anything else what made consumers buy. And I then left that, did a few other, I was a sales director at Pfizer, and I did a few other bits and pieces, and then ultimately was flying around Europe, really enjoying the lifestyle and burning out. And yeah. I quit the whole corporate scene and built my own financial services company. I borrowed heavily to do it, but I managed to sell that company after a couple of years successfully. And I achieved my financial freedom, if you like. And then sat there thinking, what am I going to do now? And I started Froggo about 5 years ago. A couple of young lads that I worked with at the time. I was quite inspired by what they wanted to achieve and got involved with them and give them a start, if you like, in terms of what they're in. I believe they've both gone on to do great things now. I started the agency, started Froggo back then. And it became very apparent very quickly that there wasn't anybody telling the truth that I was coming up against. I was buying loads of stuff and everybody was ripping everybody else off with fake information and courses. Nobody was actually telling the truth, so I decided I would, and we've gone from strength to strength from there.
That's brilliant. And you've got offices around the world now, is that right?
We're in 14 countries now, but primarily our offices are really only in three: here, America, and our main factory offices in Lithuania.
Okay, and how long has that journey been from actually deciding what you wanted and getting to here with the marketing company? How long in terms of years has that been?
From deciding, it's 5. From starting the company, it's about 4. I spent a whole year just designing, learning, reading, designing, you know, working out that those first two parts I talked about at the beginning of the meeting, the planning and the strategy. I spent a whole year doing that before.
So that's really interesting, Matt, because after 5 years, you spent 1 year, so 20% of that time strategizing to make sure that when you launched, it was all going to work fine and all the sales funnels were put in place. And for those people listening who, oh, I'm just going to do a Twitter ad today or Facebook or, oh, I'll try a bit of Google, it doesn't work like that. And, well, it does work like that, and you get the result because you've done it like that. Whereas because you've gone and implemented the strategy that you worked so hard at, that's why you've got these results. So it's planning.
Well, it is, but and what we've also managed to do in that time is actually I can make it so that anybody listening could not, they don't have to spend a year doing what I did. They could learn how to make sure that they don't get it wrong, probably in about 3 days. So understanding the process of shortening your research and getting that all into one place, you know, give yourself 5 days to be luxurious because you might want to, you know, set it down and pick it back up again. But I often take clients through like a 3-day process where they totally get where they're going, what their strategy, how they're going to do it before they spend a single penny online.
And if someone wanted to work with you in terms of them doing that, what's the entry level in terms of requirements? What sort of business do you prefer to work with? So how does someone get to work with you?
Well, I'm really lucky these days that I choose personally who I want to work with or not, which means I can take on big corporate clients, which I have. And also, I've got some, you know, one-man bands, which I love working with. I love giving that level of advice and giving that level of help. So I don't really have a demographic, an ideal customer. You know, people ask me that a lot. You know, who's your ideal? I don't have one. The ideal customer for me really has to satisfy only two criteria. They have to be ambitious enough to understand that they've got to apply themselves to the solution over time, because I can get them probably global power. But they have to understand that the global branding we've done 54 brand launches since we started. And not all of them have gone on to become strong because the application from the brand owner hasn't been there to consistently conform over time. But if you do, without question, you can become a strong player in whatever niche you choose to be in. But it requires dedication from you if you're listening to this. That's the first thing, really. I get a lot of people that want instant results, and you can get some instant results with campaigns, don't get me wrong. But I want longevity. You know, when I float this business, I want to have, you know, a whole bunch of clients that have been around for years and demonstrable success, which luckily we have. We've got more proof and evidence than you can shake a stick. And the second thing really is they've got to have an affordable budget. I don't need big 20, 30, 40 grand on the nose up front. A lot of people that do that are transactional marketers. But they've got to understand that relationship and cost, and so they've got to be able to cash flow their own marketing. They've got to be able to afford a level of marketing within their business. So as long as they've got money to spend on their business, not with me specifically, but on their business, and they have the ambition that they understand they want to dominate their marketplace, then I want to talk to them.
And so what would be an affordable budget from their point of view, do you think? Like, is it 5, 10, 15?
Well, it depends on the size of business, but what I often say to people is, if you want to dominate and really, you know, go for your market, if you're spending between 20 and 25% of your sales revenue on your marketing, you will get there. That's a fact. If you're not spending 10, you're a challenger and you'll always be a distant follower. If you're spending nothing, you're not at the match yet. You have to understand where you want to go and how you want to get there. So typically you need to be spending, you know, a good 20 to 25% of sales to get you up and running. You can scale that back over time. You won't be doing that 10 years in. You won't be spending 25% because you're not penetrating at that same level. So you can scale it back and you can sustain and maintain your business with about 10 to 15%, and that'll keep it growing in perpetuity. You know, it just keeps the thing ticking over. But to get there up front, that's what you really need to be looking at.
And is that a per month figure or is that an upfront figure?
Well, we look at it more of on an annual balance sheet, you know, because sometimes you'll spend more per month or sometimes you'll spend less per month. We've got some guys that spend a few thousand dollars. We're mostly volume-wise, we're mostly in the US where our 8 offices are. But we also get guys that, you know, they're doing a funnel for $10,000 or, you know, they've got a campaign that they want to run and launch and it's a quick and dirty thing that they want to get up and running within the, if you've built the architecture, you can do lots of low cost campaigns to leverage that architecture, but you've got to spend the money to build the architecture in the first place. But if you go to my website now, you'll find a whole bunch of stuff that we just give away. You might have to dig a wee bit to find some of it because it's in the back of funnels. But we've got a whole bunch of stuff to give away to help people qualify themselves out of my funnel, but still get something valuable in return for having visited the brand.
Yeah.
Well, I won't work with everybody that comes to my site, of course, but I want them all to have a positive impression and walk away with something they can use.
And that's frogomarketing.com.
Frogomarketing.com.
Right? Got it. Okay. So final question. If you had to start again financially, so you got £1,000, what would you do?
Well, the most obvious answer to that is I want to try and make it 10,000 as quickly as I can. So,
how would you do that?
Well, in the beginning, I'm going to take my 20% rule, my 25% rule, and I'm going to put 250 of that aside to do some actual paid media. That leaves me with 750. So I'm going to go and buy as a theme. If I haven't got a website, I'm going to go and buy a theme. At the beginning, it's a good enough theme.
Like a WordPress theme.
Yeah, a good one, like a $100 one that I can use for at least a year, knowing that I'm going to scrap it. But it needs to give me a perception. I have to create, with that money, the perception that I'm a professional. I can't do amateur. I've got to make it look like I know what I'm doing.
So that's really interesting as well, because I meet people and we go, oh, I'll get some business cards done and I'll go to that place that does them for free, that online well-known company. And I'm like, no, don't do that. You're best not having a business card if you're just going to get the cheap and cheaper. But a lot of people do.
Yeah, something is not often better than nothing. I totally agree with you. But you know, a good $100, $200 theme, and then I would get it tweaked somehow, get it tweaked a little bit for another $100. You know, it's not expensive to get them tweaked a little bit, but that's good enough. That's good enough. So where am I up to on my budget now? So
it's 450.
I've got 450 left, or I've spent 450.
550 left.
I've got 550 left. Okay. So now what I'm going to do is I'm going to assume I've got a wee bit of kit. So I'm going to cheat a bit. I'm going to assume I've got a phone with a camera. And I'm going to assume that I can take a video with that camera.
Yeah, so, you've got a phone and a PC already. Right. You've got access to those. Let's say.
So and then I'm going to write myself a little script that's under 2 minutes long. It must be under 2 minutes long, and I'm going to make a little camera video on the phone. So I'm going to use that as primarily my video sales letter for now. And I'm going to put underneath that, I'm going to build myself a sales page / script within this nice, elegant theme that I've picked and chosen. That's why I need that $100 developer to add that little bit.
Yeah.
I'm going to pick MailChimp as my autoresponder because it's free by and large, unless you want to do automation. And you can do automation when you get a bit more money in. So that's probably up to about $500 now that I've spent in terms of what I need to do. Now what I need is I need something of value to give. So I need something really decent. So I need to create a printable PDF with the designer. So either I'm going to write it myself, or I'm going to get a copywriter to do it. So probably if I've only got $1,000, I'm going to end up writing it myself. But I can't design a nice PDF. So I need a designer to do that. So I'm going to spend another $100, $150 on this really nice looking PDF that gives away the information.
So no Fiverr.com.
I use Fiverr, you know, for transcripts and stuff like that. But you could use Fiverr, Odesk maybe a little bit. But you want to spend a decent amount of money on getting that PDF done. And if you can, make it three chapters.
Perfect. Why three chapters?
Because you can break it into three resources
as opposed to
only one. And then what that allows you to do is it allows you to break up the sequence. You can start to do some measurement about, you know, someone that opened all three or downloaded all three is going to be a little bit more of a prospect for you than someone that only opened the first email and maybe took the first document. So, you know, you need a little bit of longevity. So, you know, we've just done a campaign, for example, where we've got one document, we've chopped it into six different chapters, and we've cold emailed businesses that are relevant in that niche with the first version. And then we're measuring the people that are taking the third one, the fourth one, the fifth one as they go through that particular funnel. And eventually we'll call them and invite them to talk to us.
Can I just break down that as a marketing strategy for people who want a marketing strategy? It's awesome. So you send it to cold traffic, you have six different emails, and whoever gets to email number six gets a phone call, and then you try and pitch them.
Yeah.
Pretty much.
Yeah, well, there's a more elegant way of positioning it, of course.
But that's the Yorkshire way.
And then whatever money I've got left, $300 or $400 left, do you know what I'm going to do with that? I'm not going to do Facebook advertising. I'm going to buy data.
Ah, interesting.
I'm going to buy data. Now, you can't really buy consumer data. It's not as easy to get the hold of. But business data is, because there's no spam rules around business data. And I'm going to buy data. And that's what I do a lot. I buy data. Now, on the consumer side, I probably would do some Facebook advertising or do a little bit of that planning work that I was talking about and do some Facebook advertising to test my message. But one thing I'll say, if you've got a budget of that, do not go near Facebook and spend money on Facebook. It'll eat all your money and you'll get nothing for it.
Yeah, in like 2 days.
Yeah, gone. And then it's like, what just happened? You know, the only certainty is that you'll spend it and you'll get nothing for it. So don't do Facebook when you're in that particular position. But what you can do is get your data. And I quite like your idea there of maybe getting a few leaflets printed up and dropping the leaflets around and what the conversion rate on that would be to your squeeze page. But the point I'm making is whatever you're doing, what I'm describing here is you need a little bit of money on your front end broadcasting activity, the awareness and the interest. You need the bulk of the money in the back end on the conversion environment, because that's where you're going to make that little bit of money make some more money.
Yeah,
but there's also some of that money is built on the architecture. So I'm going to re-leverage some of that money by my theme or by the MailChimp or whatever I've done with that PDF. I'm going to make more money with that a second and a third and a fourth time. So I'm going to take some of the money I make the first time. I'm going to recycle that and make more with it, and then recycle some of that money and make more with it. And actually, I know that's how I built Froggo. What people don't know is I didn't take a penny, not a single penny piece, out of the business for 3 years. So I spent a year researching before I did it, and then took nothing for 3 years and put all the money back into the company. I was lucky enough to be able to do that, of course, but I put it all back into the company and it grew on its own cash. I didn't borrow a single penny. And that's how money makes money, and that's what you do.
Yeah, we call it sweat capital. I'm not over keen on the name, but that's what it is. It's sweat capital. And the money that you generate goes back into your business. I don't think you had to go through this, but I had to go through this at various points where, you know, you survive on literally beans and potatoes for a month. And I've definitely gone through that when I started.
Oh, no, I've done that. I think every entrepreneur goes through. We've had circumstances on this journey where, you know, I'm constantly close to the edge on overtrading. You have to be very careful not to overtrade, of course, but because that great story I was telling you earlier on about me being in financial services, I had equity backers, and the mistake I made, whilst it was very successful, it wasn't successful the way it was supposed to be, because the equity backers, when I gave away 50% of the equity, I gave away control of when the company got sold. I was getting a million. It was like, great, you know, you can choose when you want to sell. I was playing with the big boys. But I didn't realize that they could sell it when they wanted. So the minute it hit 15 million, they went, we'll have our money back now, thank you. And I was like, hang on, we're going for 400 here. What are you doing?
Yeah.
And they're like, no, we've got our return. You're gone. Here's your money. Clear off. And they had control over when my company got sold. Now, I can't cry too much, can I? But it didn't do what it was supposed to do. So this time around, I've not taken any backers. You're talking about sweat capital and sweat equity. Well, not everybody can afford to wait 3 years to start making a return. So you can start, but you've got to make something of your business. You know, bear in mind, I've gone for massive growth. I've got a different agenda here, right? So
yes,
but a startup business, you need to get the 5 years, because 80% of startups die. You've got to get through that first year by feeding the business, and then you've got to start thinking about feeding the kids and feeding the family as well. And that's where you've got to start making the right balanced decision between overworking and working on the business, not in the business. And I know that we've both been through some circumstances when, you know, the family becomes a big pull as you go through that particular journey. And we've had times when there hasn't been maybe £12, maybe €20 in our account, business account. And then the next day, boom, you know, or 3 days later or over the weekend, more comes in. So you have to be very careful. And living on beans and potatoes is not a bad thing to do either.
I think it's a good lesson to learn. I think, you know, I fly back to see the kids, and we've got a budget every weekend as to how much we can spend. It's not an unlimited budget. It was a budget. And so we go to the supermarket on the Friday, and Sometimes we'll go to Lidl because it's cheap, and sometimes we'll go to Morrison's because it's not as expensive as some of the other places. But we've got a budget, and the kids are in charge of that budget to some extent, and they're 7 and 10 years of age. I can't think of a better way to teach them about managing money than not overspending. And it's not a lot for a weekend. We have £40 for a weekend. Mm-hmm. You know, we're doing really well, really, financially. And yet, we cut it to the bone because I've got to get these kids to be unindoctrinated from the UK lifestyle of, well, nothing to do at weekends, we'll go retail therapy or whatever.
I so respect you for that. I mean, that's tremendous. You know, that's definitely something people should be listening to.
Not easy. So, sometimes it's, I wouldn't say it's upsetting, but it's like, what do you want to do this weekend? And they want to do two things or three things, and there's not enough money in the budget. And so it's like, do I capitulate and just go, oh, go on then? But that there's no lesson in there.
Yeah.
Having said that, we go out on a bike, we go climbing, we go horse riding, we get our food, all for £40.
That's fantastic.
Isn't it? Right. And we budget. And then Isabel went to get a new bike helmet, and we went to the bike shop, and it was £17. She's like, I'm not buying that. And she's got a SpongeBob bike helmet at the moment, which apparently isn't trendy for a 10-year-old girl. Why we would invest in a SpongeBob helmet 5 years ago is anyone's guess anyway. But anyway, so we went to Tesco, and she saw one for £7, but it was blue. She wasn't fussed. It was £7. That's fine. And she wanted to save some money for some gloves, and it's brilliant. Whereas before, she would have got, Dad, can I have that £17 one, and I want some gloves.
Yeah, I think that's tremendous. I really respect that. You know, well, I've got four kids now, and it's a constant battle between peer pressure, right the way through to the excitement of what they see every time they go out somewhere.
Yeah, absolutely. One thing I just before we finish up, just one thing I want to go back to is we had £1,000 there. And in that £1,000, you came up with maybe six or seven things that you would do to go create a business. Yeah. Now, there's some people on the call that haven't got £1,000, and that's fine. You don't have to spend the whole £1,000 all at once.
That's right.
You know, if it's £100, then go get your WordPress theme. Get on Facebook and start driving traffic back to your WordPress theme. Your script was free of charge. You could film a video, upload it to YouTube free of charge. You have MailChimp free of charge. And so you just literally... You can email people, you can send stuff out on social media, and you can do it yourself, which isn't necessarily the best way, but you will maybe generate some business off that, even if it's just one customer at £100. What product would you sell? Would you sell a high value product, or would you sell a £100 product?
Yeah, I'm not really the right person to ask that question, because I'm very polarized on that. I go for high quality. High price. I'll tell you why, because it's as much work to do it for a £27 or a £9 product as it is for a £2,000 or a £10,000 product. Now, I don't want to put anyone off sort of talking to me after this. If that, you know, if people want to find me, then that's fine. But our typical contract prices tend to be in the region of $50,000 to $100,000 on average. Now, it's as much work to do that as it was when we started off 5 years ago. We were selling a product for £2,500, and we couldn't get people to buy enough of them at that price at just £2,500. So some of our really earliest clients got a bargain because of what was happening. But now we have a wait list of people that want to work with us, and essentially, the wisdom is exactly the same. Of course, the product is a lot different because there's a lot more service delivery, and we do a lot of done for you stuff in those numbers. We have a teaching company that teaches. We've got courses, and I speak a little bit. I think one of the value that podcasting can give you is it builds trust, and you know, providing that the blethering isn't garbage, I guess.
That's wonderful. Mark, from a personal point of view, it's great to speak to you again. I think we need to leave it less than 3 or 4 years that we've actually left it this time round.
I look forward to coming to Villa at some stage. I know I have an outstanding invitation to be able to do that.
You have an outstanding invitation.
Yeah, I look forward to seeing you soon.
Thank you very much once again, Mark.
Bye-bye. Take care.
The Property Coaching and Wealth Creation Podcast, brought to you by property and business coach Daniel Latto. Join the conversation at www.daniellatto.co.uk. Remember to like and subscribe.